Welcome to the Computing There I Was podcast. I am your host, Richie Bielak. In this podcast, we'll have conversations with veterans of the computing industry to hear about their adventures. Welcome to Computing There I Was podcast. I am your host, Richie B. And today we are talking to Eric Mintz, a software engineer recently retired from Google. So hi, Eric. How are you?
Oh, good, Richie. How are you? I'm good fine. To see you again.
Nice to see you. So on this podcast, what I hope to do is to have a conversation with people who worked in computing for a while and just to hear their stories, because there's all this cool stuff that happened in the past like 50 years. So to start with, tell me how you got interested in computers. What happened?
Oh, Lord. Well, it's all part of the space age technology, catch up with the Soviet Union. I rode that wave. If I ever get to the hereafter, there's one person I want to thank for saving my life twice, and that's Nikita Khrushchev. You laughed, but...
Just for people who might not know, when was this? This is mid-60s, right?
In the late 50s and early 60s. I don't know when Stalin died. It was after World War II, I know that.
It was in the 50s, I believe.
Yeah. When Nikita Khrushchev became the premier, he did two things for which I shall be eternally grateful, or at least for as long as I'm compos mentis. The first thing he did was launch Sputnik, which really scared the United States. I think we could use another Sputnik moment, but it all of a sudden the United States realized that the people who were interested in technology, the people who'd been on the outs, were actually a national resource. And there was a whole spate of attention to education that gave us the school mathematics study group, the new math that unfortunately didn't work, I think largely because teachers were not prepared to teach it. I was fortunate to have a teacher who did know how to teach it. The man saved my life. I named my son after him, Commander John P. Howitt. You and your whole family are missed. And then the other thing that Nikita Khrushchev did was allow me to survive to be an adult by backing down during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm no historian. There's lots of information on it, but the world teetered at the brink of nuclear holocaust for a couple of weeks. And
so what grade was that teacher in?
He was my seventh grade mathematics. He was my mentor all through high school. And he encouraged me to develop mathematically. Showed me that mathematics and arithmetic were different subjects, totally different ways of thinking, used totally different parts of the brain. I, by actual examination, am the world's worst clerk. In terms of the clerical aptitude, I score in the third percentile in terms of spatial, mathematical, inductive, deductive reasoning. I score very high.
Yeah, I took a test like that when I was in high school. So my spatial reasoning also was kind of up there.
Yeah.
So, but let's get to computers. So where the computers come in here?
Well, there I was in seventh grade. I have to preface this by saying I spent my childhood and reached my adult height and weight in Ithaca, New York. Whether I grew up, of course, is a completely different matter. But it's a university town and in some respects, one of the last bastions of feudalism in the United States. The society there at the time was highly stratified with the university faculty in charge. And one son of a faculty member named Tom, not the faculty member, but my classmate, Tom Dimmick, again, to whom I'm eternally grateful, was in my geometry class. He suggested that we go bum computer time from Cornell. And I say that the difference between me and the juvenile delinquents in my cohort was the value of the items we stole. You know, they'd shoplift trinkets and I'd steal hours of computer time, and
so how,
very expensive.
How did you manage to do that? So first of all, what kind of computer was this?
It was a Control Data 1604, and they had an open to undergraduates policy of you could sign in and write a small program in a teaching language called Quark, which is on Eric Raymond's collection of bad computer languages. If you want to give it a try, you can actually download it. I did it once. I didn't ever tried it.
So how, but, when you say you wrote the programs, how did you actually enter them to computer? Was it punch cards?
Yeah, it was absolutely punch cards. You went to the campus store, you bought the coding
right.
forms. Coding was very rigid. Everything had to be just so. And one of the first sort of, my second computer programming language was IBM Drum Card, because you could...
Oh, you mean the drum card that goes in the key punch?
Yes, exactly, where you set up the card punch equivalent of tab stops.
I guess for our listeners, maybe I'll put a link in the notes to like a video of a key punch so you can see what we're talking about.
Right. Now, be sure to, it's the O26, not the O29. The O29 was the high price spread. I don't even think it had been introduced yet. Mm.
Okay, so there you are.
There I am, happily writing Quark.
So what was Quark like as a language? Was it close to assembler or was it more like basic?
It was deliberately designed to be easy to use for the time language. It's been described as a mixture of a bit of Algol and linear programming and random stuff. One of the things it tried to do is when it detected a mistake, mm-hmm. it tried to correct it. For example, if you misspelled a variable, it would assume.
Right.
And
I have a similar experience. I used PLC, which was, I think was a version of PL1 from, was it from Cornell?
Yes, same professor, Professor Conway.
And it did the same thing. And I remember that when you make a mistake and try to correct it, sometimes you would just go off completely into the weeds. Yeah.
We've seen this return, haven't we? I've not tried it.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, I've not tried it. But anyway, PLC has been said to stand for programming language by Professor Conway.
I see.
But I think the C was meant to stand for Cornell. Anyway, so I had the same teacher of that geometry class, who I will not name, decided to help a few of us who wanted to use computing. So he gave us the book, which was nice. I read the book. In order to read the book, now remember, I was in 15, sophomore.
Right.
Hadn't taken pre-algebra, hadn't taken anything. Here was a course that presumed at least pre-calculus. So I had to learn about radians. I had to learn trigonometric identities. I had to learn natural logarithms. I had to learn all this stuff that was... I was slated to learn the next mm-hmm. year. That had interesting implications when I got to that course. It was a case of, oh, please, could we please learn something? You know, while my classmates struggled, it was not really very considerate of me. You know, I owe a number of people a number of apologies for that. But, you know, youth.
Right.
But anyway, my first program was, well, I was looking for something that was simple to understand and hard to do. Something I could understand, but either could not or would not do by hand. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that I could approximate pi by calculating the area of a unit circle by treating it as a series of trapezoids.
Right.
Okay. A trapezoidal rule, you know.
It's basically calculus, really. Yeah.
It's
integration.
It's integration. It is. And I knew it. But in any case, so I set the program up, and I wanted to see how it converged with, as you narrowed the width of the
little
trapezoids, yeah. And of course, thinking it now from, well, this was 1965, so goodness me, it's what, 70 years ago now? I never was good at arithmetic.
Me neither.
60 years ago.
Yeah.
So I did it backwards, okay? You, when you add a list of floating point numbers, you want to add from the smallest to the largest to preserve significance. But what did I know back then?
Right.
Enough.
Well, you had floating point numbers. That's good.
That's good. Yeah. That's all that Cork had was floating points.
Okay.
And I think it had strings too. That's it. But in any case, so I set it up and I coded it on the coding pads and I showed it to the advisor and he looked at it and he said to me, I remember this like it was yesterday, which probably means I remember it badly, but he said to me, is that your first program? And I said, well, yeah, I've never written one before, so yes. And you're going to calculate pi. I said, well, I hope to. He said, don't you want to do something simpler like read two numbers, add them, and print the result? I said, no, I could do that by hand. It's not very interesting at all. He said, well, if that's your first program, you're out of here. So I picked up my program and I left. And I went up to Cornell and I punched it up. And after, you know, many attempts at getting it work, I did.
Did it produce a good result?
It produced a decent result. I got five figures out of it.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah. And so I took it over and showed it to Mr. Howitt, who just crowed. And then he showed me another cool way to calculate pi by Monte Carlo method.
Yeah. Right.
You know it?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. You throw pins on the...
Exactly. You throw darts at the unit square, and which is very cool. I understand it converges relatively slowly. I've not analyzed it.
I haven't tried it.
But I did it. There was a random number generator in Cork, so it was really very nice. And then I sort of said, well, okay, I'd like to try Fortran and assembler. Now, for that, you required money. Mm-hmm. Now, what I did was I gathered my programs together. I walked into the office of the director, John Rudan at
Cornell.
Cornell, yeah. I told him who I was. I told him what I was doing. And I asked for access, and he gave me a staff account.
Wow. And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was very cool. I learned a big lesson from that. And you probably, having worked with me, realized that I'd much rather beg forgiveness than be denied permission.
Right.
We can talk about that.
So, well, let's talk about, so what happened after high school? You went to college and you studied?
Well.
Oh, did you?
No, there's more stories.
Oh, there's more?
Sure. First of all, the math teacher, 3 months after the math teacher ejected me from the computer club, I was teaching him. Okay. And then a professor from the business school came to me and said, Eric, I need help. I have no money for salaries, but I have lots of money for computer time. He said, are you willing to do that? I said, absolutely. He said, absolutely. Okay. And then he came to me, he said, well, I have to pay you a token. I have to pay you $10 a month to get you on the workman's comp. I said, okay, that's $10 more than I was expecting. That's fine. And there I was. I had the computer. I could use it overnight when nobody else was using it. I had this computer.
So how did, was all still batch, right?
You
fed in your cards. And the output comes out.
And the most,
later.
If you want my nomination for best computer equipment I've ever seen in my life, it was the Control Data 405 card reader. It read 2,000 cards a minute, which is fast. It was gentle as a lamb, okay, and it very seldom jammed. I saw the IBM equivalent. It was slower. It was rougher on the cards, and it jammed far more frequently. I just have never seen anything so a mechanical mechanism so elegant in my life. It just magnificent the way everything just worked. Had a little vacuum. It sucked the cards against the belt, shot them through. Read them twice, validated them. It's incredible. It was just, everybody says, oh, yeah, primitive bunch batch. Yeah. No.
Those are pretty amazing machines.
No.
Mechanically.
Yeah. Yeah. So I got acknowledgments in papers, you know, for, I wasn't an author or anything, but a thank you for helping. So now, off to college, right?
Did you go to Ithaca or Cornell?
Cornell, yeah. And I have a job in the computing center, and I have a little desk where the students work. And, you know, a couple of weeks in, I met my dorm advisor going into Rand Hall, the computing center. The government department had the third floor, and the computing center had the floors, the ground floor. And so, being respectful, I liked him. I held the door for him. He looks at me and he says, Eric, what are you doing here? And having no conception of what I was saying, none whatsoever, I said, oh, Seth, I'm going to my office. He says, right, you know, pull my other leg now. I said, no, honestly, truthfully, I'm going to my office. I'll show you. He said, I have to see this. And there it was, my desk all piled up with big computer listings and all this stuff. I said, had my little name on the panel with the dymo maker. And he said, there it is. I said, I've been working here for at least a year now. I started in high school. He said, I'll be doggone. you guys amaze me. So there it was, and I was working. I walked up to my soon-to-be advisor, my physics 207 professor. I majored in physics, and I almost majored in math as well.
I was going to ask you, what was your major? Was there a computer major at the time?
No, there wasn't. And I really, you know...
Yes, I know.
Yeah,
we can talk about that, yeah.
But yeah, I'm very glad for my choice of majors. But anyway, you know, I said to him, hello, Dr. Castle. And he says, hi, Eric. And I said, you know, I work here. If there's anything I can do, any way I can help out, just ask, please. And he gives me this sidelong look, which, of course, being young, I didn't understand how outrageous I was being. Right? I just wanted to be polite and, you know, also, you know, become a member of the research community. I really wanted this, okay? And then, you know, later on, he started asking me to help. And later on, past that, he said, you know, he said, I didn't believe you. I thought you were just a wiseacre until I asked around. And people said, oh, no. You know, take him up on it. He knows what he's doing. He's got experience. And so, you know, I did all kinds of interesting work for him. We did a feasibility study on using an IBM 1800 to detect, you know, particle collisions in real time. It didn't really have the horsepower for it. Yeah, it was out at the airport in Ithaca, and I didn't drive at the time. So I had to go out. I don't know. I'd have to look to see. It's at least a couple of miles. And at the time, Tripphammer Road out by the airport was deserted. Many's the night I walked back at 2 and 3 in the morning, no street lights, walking down the middle of the night on the dotted line so I wouldn't roll off into the swamp on either side. And when I heard a car coming, I'd get off to the side. So there were adventures. But the biggest adventure was having unfettered access to computing, which was absolutely unheard of at the time. That and a Marchant mechanical calculator that my dad picked up for me. Oh. Just being able to run a least squares from my desk at the time was incredible. I have a story about least squares. You want to hear it?
Okay.
One of the summer jobs I had was at a company called Sage Action. If I can throw in a shameless plug, if you have anything to do with airflow, and I tried to get a former employer to do this, and they didn't, and far to their disadvantage. If you deal with cooling, HVAC, airflow, anything involving the movement of air, especially for cooling or heating, look into the Sage Action bubble generator. I was there when it was made. It blows these little soap bubbles about an eighth of an inch in diameter filled with helium, and they're neutrally buoyant. And they can visualize transonic turbulent airflow. It's the only thing that I know of that can do it.
I've seen pictures of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was there when it was invented. But we had a contract with the Cornell Department of Agriculture. They had an 1130. And we'd do calculations for people. And this woman gave me this involved statistical procedure for fitting calibrating anemometers, a polynomial 1 over x squared, 1 over x, x to the 0, x to the 1, x squared fit this.
Right.
She gave me the data and the figures, and it just blew up. It was awful. And so I dumped the matrix, and the correlation coefficients were all very high. Mm-hmm. So I calculated its determinant, and it was somewhere around 10 to the minus 22. I mean, okay, ain't going to happen because there was inverting the matrix in it. So I called her, and I said, well, you know, you've got a nearly singular matrix. Its determinant is 10 to the minus 22. Now, this is high school stuff.
Okay, yeah.
She's sort of, I think, reaching to keep up with me. I said, this procedure is numerically infeasible. I think, how about a nice least squares? And she asked me, what's that? So I told her about it. You know, you differentiate the coefficient, you look for the zero, and gives you a pretty good fit. Can I try it? She said, sure. That worked out very nicely. I plotted, I sent her the graph. She said, fine, good. This is the woman who also asked me to apply Simpson's rule to a polynomial times e to the x. And I said, oh, it's got to have a closed form. So I had a handbook of chemistry and physics, being a physicist there.
Right.
Flipped the integral. There it is, right? Call her up. I said, look, customer's always right. I'll do it the way you ask if you want. But there's a closed form solution. And she said, it would be a whole lot faster, a whole lot more accurate to just use that. So what do you think? And she said, well, how do I trust the answer? And I said, well, I think we can trust the handbook of chemistry and physics. And she said, okay, go ahead. But, you know, there are lessons in that, which is people talk about having a third eye. Well, you need a third ear if you're writing software. You have to essentially backtrack from the customer's request to the customer's need.
Right.
And that's the real challenge. It's a psychological game.
Right. So let's talk about what happened after you graduated. So what was your job? Your first job clearly was at the college, but...
Well, I went off to graduate school.
I went to graduate school?
Yeah, thinking I would study mathematics, mm-hmm. and discovered that I was probably smart enough to get a PhD, and I might be able to inveigle a faculty job somewhere, but I never was going to make it. I'm not that smart. And I later discovered also I have the very much worst personality, worst psychological orientation for academia. My interests are very broad. I'm basically, if I'm interested in something, I want to belong to it, all of it.
Right.
And that's not academia. It was academia maybe 300 years ago, but now academia is deep and narrow.
Right.
Okay. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing that there are people who love that. We need both.
Right.
But it's not me. And so I'm sure happened. That you noticed, and, you know, when we worked together, it could appear that I have a lack of focus when actually what I've done is I've taken a problem and found a more general approach to it.
Well, that's a very mathematical approach.
Very mathematical indeed.
So what happened?
In graduate school, I failed my qualifiers and went and got a master's. This in spite of doing extremely well in all courses. I actually was working for the university for a while to stay out of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I was auditing courses. My abstract algebra teacher came to me and said, Eric, you're not registered for the course. I said, no, I'm auditing it. He said, well, go register right now. And I said, well, okay, but what makes you tell me to do that? Because you got the highest mark in the class. I said, I can't really. It might attract unwanted attention. He said, but thanks very much. So later when I wanted to go to the university, I asked him, would you mind writing me a letter of recommendation? And he said, sure, where are you applying? I said, well, here. And he said, oh, I'm on the admissions committee. Best letter of recommendation. I don't have to write a thing. So it happened. Anyway, So then I made a mistake. I got involved in the light water breeder reactor program, helping to design a nuclear reactor that bred thorium-232 into uranium-233, which sounded fascinating. And the physics is fascinating, but the engineering is, I absolutely understand why and I absolutely support it. You go step by step by step by step. Everything's double-checked, verified, scrutinized intensely. If you use a little trig, well, for example, we were very interested in the position of the rods in a bundle. Mm-hmm. Okay, these nuclear reactors are fuel and zirconium rods because zirconium is transparent to neutrons surrounded by water. That's a pressurized nuclear reactor, pressurized water reactor. And to do your thermodynamics properly, to calculate the neutron distribution properly, you have to know where everything is.
Right.
So the question is, my boss said, well, I need to know the average distance between these rods so I can calculate how much of what stuff is in there. And I said to him, it sounds to me like the average distance, the mean distance between the rods is not that the root mean area might actually be more relevant because you really want to know the average cell size.
If you say so.
Well, you know, it's not only how far apart are the rods, but how much stuff is around it. And you're using an average, which is linear, to calculate a square, which is nonlinear. Mm-hmm. So rather than calculating the average and then just calculate the average of what you want rather than, you know, what you can measure. It turns out to be very simple. Okay.
So,
but that went up two levels of management.
Yeah, I have stories like that too. So what kind of computing was used in this?
Well, it was all highly numeric, Cray 6600, 7600.
Okay.
We had a PDP-10 kind of as a front end. Mm-hmm. And of course, everything was locked down because I didn't do any work on anything military. This had absolutely no military application. But there was work on military applications.
So you said you made a mistake because of that.
Well, yes, it was. Well, it was the wrong field for me.
I see.
Okay. The field for me is hardcore computer programming, particularly involving data modeling.
So what happened at the nuclear reactor then?
A guy from New York, whom I met at the computing center, named Al Kaskill, who used to tease me almost to the point of tears, okay? And who I knew through Sage Action, if I could backtrack a bit, when I graduated from graduate school, came back home because I had no place else to go. They were waiting for my security clearance. They apparently were coming through slowly, or maybe I needed extra scrutiny, I don't know. But in any case, I went out to Sage Action. I called them up and I told them I was available. I said, well, we don't have any work, but we'd love to see you. So I came out, and there was a ModComp 2.
What's a ModComp 2?
It's the computer that I got in work, a big thing in the old computer museum. It's a old 16-bit real-time process control computer. It flew the space shuttle from the ground. Okay, ModComp flew the space shuttle. And it was, you know, one of these niche computing that was far better value than anything the majors were offering. So they bought one. And there it was sitting in its shipping container. Everything about it was different from the IBM 1130. It used a different floating point form representation.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Well, there was no IEEE at the time. Every manufacturer had their own.
Right.
It used ASCII instead of EBCDIC.
Okay.
And it actually had quite a bit more memory than the 1130. So I said to myself, well, all that, they think they don't have work for me, but there's plenty of work. So a few days later, they called me up and said, well, you know, we do have to port these programs. We got a month worth of work for you, so why don't you come on out? Okay, great. Work's work. So I come out, and there was a 32-bit arithmetic package on the IBM 1130 called the Ideal. Mm-hmm. It's one of these unsupported packages that IBM gave away. And the company that was doing the, Al Kaskel's company, Manimation, was doing the port. And they had this idea, while they had this kind of homegrown Fortran, what I considered half cook, half binary, half decimal arithmetic, just, oh, we'll just rip that out and put our own in. And then people looked at the size of the work, and they said, oh my gosh, this is going to be a nightmare. Of course, me being me, you know, I said, well, why don't we just rewrite this package for the ModCom? I looked at it, had all the hardware support we needed. So I just started to write it. And, you know, I was, well, I can do this. You know, I'll make it, we'll make it easy. We'll just rewrite it.
And this wasn't Fortran? Or wasn't,
I wrote it in an assembler. The code was in Fortran that we were porting, but this was an assembler.
Right.
Because I needed access to some
Add
with carry and that sort of thing.
Bit fiddling.
Yeah, bit fiddling, basically. So about halfway through the project, Don Ordway, whom I also love, the Sage Action was the kind of company, if you were working late, Don would bring you dinner. Whatever he was eating, he'd bring over to you. Or he'd come over and say, go home. Go home. Come back tomorrow. And he said, what are you writing this in, by the way? And I said, assembler. Is it? What else would you write it in? Oh, you got to talk to Alvin about this. We do everything in Fortran. So I called up Alvin. And Alvin, Don wants me to talk with you about writing it in an assembler. And Alvin said, of course, you write it in an assembler. But I had to go back to Don. Alvin says, it's okay, you know, special case.
Right.
You know, make people feel happy. That's a lesson I'm still learning. So anyway, there it was. We ported some stuff for Sage Action and Animation and all this. We also had a contract with the local community college, and we were doing their port. And I was over there just in case something goes wrong. I had not ported the Fortran code. I'd written the support libraries. Right. And one of the guys was sort of looking at me, seeing around, reading or something. And he says, what the hell is that bozo doing there? And my colleague, Jimmy, at the time, he says, if it weren't for him, this project wouldn't make it. Don't diss him. Okay. He has nothing to do now because he did his job earlier. And that is the height of compliment. You know, your fondest hope, or at least my fondest hope when I write software, is not to be noticed. Is for people to say, and every once in a while somebody says, how do I do ABC with this system? And I say, well, do this, 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 and this. And people, is that all? Yeah, that's all you have to do, really, just this, 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 and this. And they say, well, but how is it so easy? I said, well, you know, it's my job to make your life easy.
Right.
I want it to be easy. I want you to say, because this is not how you add value. You add value with what you do that makes you want to do A, B, C, and D. But of course, there's always the danger with the people who can't or don't or have this orientation where I don't even understand it. It's like everything has to be visible. They'll say, well, if it's so simple to use, it must have been simple to write.
Right.
No, no. Simplicity is hard.
Okay. I think Doug goes back to Pascal. I think he may have said something.
Yes,
like
he
that.
Did.
All right. So then somebody from New York called you?
Yes, I was working at Westinghouse Atomic Power Division. Mm-hmm. My year of indentured servitude was up. I didn't have to pay back my relocation. I started looking for work. And out of the blue, Alvin called me and said, come work for me in New York. We'll get you an apartment. And because he was hooked up with one of his customers. Mm-hmm. He was related. Anyway, you know, we'll get you an apartment and I'll pay you X. And insurance is great. When do I start? So I moved to New York. I had far more fun than the law allowed. It was on an IBM 1130 and the worst, most wretched computer I ever worked on. Varian Data Machine 16-bit. It was dreadful.
Why?
Well, the hardware was unreliable. I know you're not supposed to diss things, but it broke all the time. Mm. The software was unreliable. It was awkward to use. The card reader was unreliable. And we did some amazing work on it. We did an early, possibly the first, call up and charge a theater ticket application. Okay. All punch cards, all everything.
This is in like 70s, early 70s?
Yeah, early 70s, mid 70s. It's called okay. Charge It.
Okay.
And cool. We ran them every night. And it was quite something.
So let me ask you. So you were still using punch cards then, right?
Yep, still using punch cards.
How did things change when first PCs came around?
Well, actually, it started changing before that because mm-hmm. Manimation bought two Prime 300s, moved out to Long Island, mm-hmm. and we started doing online services, okay, with the terminals, right? That's the intermediate. Right. That was my first personal computer, right. Okay? Very expensive. We were using phone lines, 1200 baud.
Right.
And again,
high speed
for the time. You know, I'll get to the story about that, but if you don't mind, here's another beg forgiveness instead of asking permission.
Uh-huh, go ahead.
Okay. There was a data entry clerk, and I met her, and I ended up liking her very much. I owe her a lot. I don't think I ever thanked her properly for this. The terminals we were using had cursor control keys, but we weren't using them. We're using them as glass teletypes with cursor addressing. She was using the cursor control keys to correct. She thought she was correcting bad entries, and the data was completely corrupt. And my boss was yelling at her. And I said to him, look, let me just go talk with her. Let me go see what's going on, okay? So I come in, I met her, I said, hi, you know, talk about the data. I said, I'm not going to yell at you. I said, just show me what's going on. And she shows me how she's trying to do it. And I said, I thought about this for a second. And I had an epiphany. I said, you know something? He said, you're right and I'm wrong. I said, you are right. It should work that way. It really should. I mean, unfortunately, it doesn't. Not yet. I said, I don't know if we can make it work that way or not. But let me propose the following. Make a deal with you. If you do it the way we need it done now, I will do my absolute level best to make it work the way you think it should. Because you're right. You're right. Okay. But we need you to do it this way. And she said, okay. And you're so nice. You don't yell at me. Everybody else yells at me. I said, well, let's get this sorted. Okay. If I can make it, you are right. If I can make it work that way, it'll be good for everybody. So, like everything else, I started to do it. It turns out, just by accident, we had bought the exact terminals with the exact features we need because they had this halfway mode between full screen and start-stop called line mode, where you could read a line at a time, mm-hmm. okay? And that would fit in the Prime 300's buffers. So I started writing the software. And Al comes up to me and says, Eric, what the heck are you doing? And I said, we're going to have full screen mode. We're going to support full screen on these terminals. He says, no, I can't afford that. I said, well, look, I said, you can't afford not to. Okay, because looking at our software, we spend 80 to 90% of our time, of our lines of code, managing the screen. I said, we got to automate that. We have to offload this to a library. You see something here, Richie? Yeah, okay. And my apologies to the audience for the in-joke. But I said, okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm your friend, so I'm not going to do what you tell me, but here's what I will do. I said, I will give you a good, solid 40 hours a week or more on applications, and if I choose to work overtime, okay, I'll work on this. I'll work on this on my time. I said, I'm doing this because I'm your friend. And I meant it 100%. He said, well, if you work more, you should work on the applications. I said, well, look, Al, you paying overtime? He says, no. I said, okay. So if I choose to work extra, voluntarily, it seems to me fair that I should be able to work on what I want to. He says, you know, I can't argue with that. And he's a mensch. He was a real mensch. A week later, he calls me up and says, you know that back burner project you're working on with the screens? I said, yes. He said, give it top priority. You're right. He said, I've seen it work. You're right. We have to do this. We did it. I said to him, you won't regret this. In 3 months, you're going to gain back every minute of time I spend on this, and it'll all be gravy after that. Mm-hmm. He said, and it was. I mean, I converted software. I would take 8 cards out of 10, 9 cards, and throw them out. Just throw them out. Replace them with one call. And the users loved it. The developers loved it. Everybody loved it. Okay? But it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't been snarky and
right.
contrary and unmanageable. I'm not always right. Goodness knows.
Okay. So you're right. First we went with punch cards, then we moved to terminals.
Right. And then we moved to personal computers.
When PCs arrived.
Well, there I was consulting, right? When sort of Manimation stopped being a good place for me to work, I went off and became a freelance consultant on Prime. I was doing stuff with their machines that they couldn't do. For example, we had a client, a dear friend of mine still works there. They were moving to Prime. They used a quirk of the IBM 1130 software that 0 divided by 0 was 0.
Ugh.
Go figure. But that's the way it was, and they used it. Because on the 1130, you used everything you could get your hooks into.
Damn
it was
engineers.
So how do we make this work on the Prime? And, regional analyst said, can't be done. I said, well, let's have a look. I said, I knew something about Prime. They use something called virtual I/O and virtualization, where the interrupts would reflect back into user space.
Mm-hmm.
So I poked around in the segmented loader of all things, what supported 32-bit software, and I saw the arithmetic fault catcher and what it did. I said, well, it looks to me as if I just clear a couple of registers, 0 divided by 0 will be 0. Tried it, and it worked. I called the salesman. I said, I got this. And, one of the regional analysts come up to me and shook my hand. He said, I hear you've been working miracles. I said, well, gosh, thanks. And how many times have you heard me say this when we worked together? But there it was. So after that, I got this 10-day gig at Solomon Brothers. We need to do this. And I went to them. I said, well, look, I could write this code you want, but let me show you this utility. Okay. And if you do use
this. Was on Primes?
This was on Primes, yeah. Mm-hmm. If you use this, as long as you don't need to change these three fields, which were key fields, I said, it'll do what you need. I said, is that what you need? I said, I don't want to take your money if you unnecessarily. And that, of course, drew the attention of the guy who was running the group, who called me aside and shows me something running on an 8-bit machine, and said, I want to do this on the IBM PC. Are you interested? I said, yeah. And that's how I got into PC. Unfortunately, like so many products, the bulk of products that get introduced, it flopped. Okay. But
which product flopped? The one,
that we tried to write. We called it the idea processor.
Okay.
Anyway.
So did you from then on just work on PCs?
Then I just started working on PCs. And one thing led to another. I had a client that wanted their time series analytics software moved from the Prime to the PC. I did it.
So on Prime, what kind of programming languages did you guys use?
We use Fortran almost exclusively with a little bit of assembler.
Okay.
Okay. There was PL1, and the Prime 32-bit series was designed for PL1. It had the most interesting combination of firmware and operating system software I've ever seen. I've never seen anything like it. The operating system was Multics.
Okay.
And semaphores, process switching, queues, and some other normally operating system level functionality was built into the instruction set. Built into the instruction set was processes are either waiting on some semaphore or on the ready list. Highest priority process on the ready list runs.
Right.
Runs until it does I/O or waits on a semaphore. And so the idle task was the schedule. It just ran around looking at semaphores, looking for semaphores right. to notify. The interrupt instructions were one or two, interrupt routines were one or two instructions long. They just nailed semaphores. Everything was on a semaphore. It was incredible.
Multics was developed, was it at MIT?
MIT, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the MIT versus New Jersey.
Yeah. Prime was, one of their mottos was Multics in a matchbox. Mm.
So then let's fast forward a little bit. What happened when the internet arrived? Oh, wait, were you involved like in Usenet, all those kinds
no,
of things?
No, nothing like that. No, I couldn't get on the internet. I got on the internet late. Mm. Well, how did the internet arrive? Well, don't remember how I got on the internet. I tried to get on Rutgers internet. They wouldn't let me.
Did you use like remember a CompuServe?
I used a local ISP called CastleNet.
Okay.
For email, and email was Pine, and you know, the odd this and that, but I'm not, still am not a heavy internet user.
But I'm just curious in terms of the actual work that you were doing.
What was my first internet job? I don't remember what my first internet job was, but somehow I ended up at eMeta. Oh, I wasn't, before that, I was in a really nasty company, Direct Revenue. I was brought in to help them go legit. They were in the, lock your hook into Windows and show you ads business. And I was trying to help them get into the legitimate advertising on websites business. Mm-hmm. That went south. And, I remember how the progression. Now, I actually came to work at Information Builders.
Okay. What was that company?
They made Focus, a 3GL, very prominent in its day. I think it's still in use. I was in the edit division, which was
So Focus was like an early database with like a programming language. You could build applications on top of it.
Yes, it was like a hierarchical database, maybe with a little network thrown in. I never learned it, even though I worked there. I worked on basically cross-platform, cross-database software, middleware. My first project was on the my first project was hooking Lotus 1-2-3 to Focus.
Oh, interesting.
We had a Focus to SQL translator. 1-2-3 had a SQL interface, data lens. And so my job was to, the boss came in. I had the world's shortest interview there. I looked at him. He looked at me. We chatted briefly. And he said, well, I'll let you know. I wish I could let you know now, but I can't. I'll call you in a couple days. And I was hired. And he gave me the, developer's manual for data lens. Says, well, do this. Let me know how you're doing every once in a while. And I was getting up one feature a week. One major feature every 3 weeks.
So what were you programming on PCs in?
C.
C, okay.
C, yeah, I switched to C. And then that was sort of how I got, that was the company where I got to know the internet. Worked at various other places.
Did you get to use Unix at any of those places? Oh,
yes, Unix started. I had a Sun workstation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Which one, Solaris or Aprilia?
Solaris. I had one in my house for a while, too. Yeah. I bought one used because I got, and I still think it's great, I got enthusiastic about the Schlaier-Meller methodology, which models software as...
That's when object-oriented programming kind of started happening.
Yes.
You're talking about mid-90s?
Yeah. Model software as a Petri net of state machines. And I still write software that way. People say my software looks different. And that's one of the reasons why. So, I managed to get my hands on the premier modeling tool at the time, IOOA from Kennedy Carter, and I needed a Sun workstation. So I bought a used one and ran it. I still think it's a magnificent software development environment. Nobody uses it, but during that day, I supervised an independent study project at the local high school, a student who's now a big wheel at NVIDIA, ran the school out of math courses between his sophomore and junior year. He went off to Rutgers and took calculus. And the assistant superintendent called me. They knew me, and they said, "Can you do something for us? We need a math course for this kid." We talked, and he wanted to model. He was interested in chaotic behavior, wanted right. to model an ecosystem. And I said, "I have the perfect methodology for do this. Let's do it." And we did it all by hand. And he wrote 3,000 lines of C++ code from it in 6 weeks.
That's pretty
He was basically just hand translating the model into C++. Everything integrated smoothly. It just slid together. There were two bugs. One bug, one defect every 1,500 lines of code, which is IBM's gold standard. Okay. And we traced those bugs back to the model. Okay. And he ended up presenting his results at an international software conference.
Nice.
I listed him as senior author because he did all the work. Anyway, C++, that happened at Information Builders. I had this Rush project for IBM.
Didn't you also win some kind of a movie award?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so tell me about that.
Well, this is bound up with my courtship with Shelley. Mm-hmm. I was sick and tired of the New York social scene. Shelley was living in Los Angeles and sick and tired of the Los Angeles social scene. We both sort of wanted to meet somebody nice and settle down. Basically, her best friend married my best friends, and they set us up cross country.
Nice.
So we started writing letters. I even bought a fountain pen. Then we started talking. I got into IBM's long distance service for a time so I could retain at least some of the money I brought in. Mm. And my buddy Dick Bernstein from graduate school came in and showed me a project he was working on. He cut sound, and he's cut sound for really famous peoples like James Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I worked on Batman and Back to the Future, it turns out. So his idea was, take an IBM PC, put a top-end graphics card in it with that could take external video and do the movie sound cues using the computer. The way they're done, the way they had been done classically, is you take a print and you mutilate it. You need to put a metronome track in. You actually punch holes in the soundtrack so that it would click.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. And if you were going to have a piece of the music that had to synchronize with a particular action, like, for example, sometime there'll be a shot of somebody carrying a briefcase and they're going to make a handoff. They put the briefcase down and there'll be a cymbal clash or a,
right.
I forget the name for it. What's the musical name for when you hit the music hard?
Accent?
An accent, but there's a particular Italian word for it. Anyway. Mm-hmm. You actually, the 10 frames before, you lay a ruler on the film and you scratch it. And then you punch out the frame where you want the music to be so that the conductor can see, here it comes with the line moving across the screen and flash. So I did the real-time kernel for this. I had to hook the clock interrupt, speed it up. Okay, we'd have a whole queue of events.
Right.
We'd just chew through it. One of the events in the queue was advance the computer clock. Okay, because we didn't want to lose track of the time of day, of course. And that won an Oscar and an Emmy, used in TV and music production.
You mean the system itself?
The system itself, yes.
Oh, cool.
So I have an Emmy Award in my... Yeah.
In your lair.
Yep.
So what I... You know, we've been talking for almost an hour. What I wanted to ask you... What I like, as part of this podcast, I would like to have people kind of give advice to up and new software engineers, people who are just getting into the field.
Okay.
What is your advice? So I want to ask about that. Also, I know you've interviewed lots of people, and I like your interview questions, so I'd like to talk about that as well.
Okay.
But let's talk about the advice.
Okay. Computer software development, unless you're really in the bowels of the operating system, and even then this holds, is largely a psychological game. One of the most important aspects is empathy. Remembering that we're servants. Okay, we serve our users.
You sound like a character from Tron.
Well, okay, I've never seen... actually, I did see Tron, I think. I don't remember it, but I did see it. But we are. Look, who funds us? Who pays us? Who gives us our satisfaction? You know, those of us who write software that, you know, makes it out in the real, in the general world. I don't want to say the real world, because every aspect of the world is real.
Well, if I may interrupt, so like one of the things I advise students when, which kind of saying essentially what you're saying is, I tell them, you know, study humanities, because you'll be building systems for humans.
Exactly. And then I think we're both fans of Poirot, aren't we? But as Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot would say, you must use the little gray cells. And it's true, you know. Learn how to solve problems. It's much more important to learn how to solve problems than to learn technology. The technology will sort itself as you use it. But learn how to see a problem. Learn how to solve a problem. Learn how to translate a user's request for a particular system into a statement of need. One of the things I ask in job interviews, you know, sort of towards the end, I say, who's that? And the other thing I say, but I need to know one thing. One thing where I want to start is, where does it hurt? Every organization has a set of problems that, great, you know, they hold things back, but they don't seem to be, they never become acute, but they're chronic. I said, I'm interested in those problems, okay? Because I found that solving them yields far more benefits than everybody, you know, generally anybody ever conceived. Those are the grit in the works. That's what I like to, I like to clean that out, okay? So learn to solve problems. You know, for goodness sakes, learn about yourself. Okay, learn what you like to do. Learn what you don't like to do. Pay attention to what you do well. Pay attention to what you don't do well. Okay, that matters too. You know, people say, oh, my weaknesses. Oh, my gosh, it's terrible. No, it's you. It's you. You have to live with it. You have no choice. Pay attention to it. Okay, learn how to live with it gracefully. I'm the world's worst clerk. I live with it as gracefully as I can. You know, I live in a world where clerkship trumps everything. Okay, every time you do anything, you have to be a clerk. Go pick up a prescription at the grocery store. Buy groceries. Go, I don't know. Get your driver's license renewed. Anything. You run against clerkship. You know, we're a society of clerking.
Well, what exactly do you mean?
Filling out forms. Filling out a form that seems simple to everybody. I always take two copies.
Uh-huh.
One to mess up and then scratch over and then copy from the one I messed up to the one I turn in. Mm-hmm. Always. You'll always see me take two. I'm not trying to be selfish. I don't want to generate the waste, but I need it. Everybody has something. Now, when it comes to solving problems, I advocate the following with the caveat that it doesn't apply to everybody, but I suggest that everybody give it a try. Okay? Start with the nouns. What's in it? What's it made of? How do the pieces interrelate? Okay. And go finer and finer and finer and finer. For example, okay, let's look at a typical business concept, a customer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Ask yourself the question, am I a customer? Well, that question is incomplete. Okay. You can't just be a customer in isolation. You have to be a customer of some other organization. So what is a customer? Do customers walk around in the real world? No, people walk around in the real world and they act as customer. Customer is not a first-class object in the way that people and coffee cups and chairs and tables and computers and the natural numbers are, okay? Customer is a role. You learn that.
What do you need help with regarding a customer who is a role? Please provide more details so I can.
Leave that in. You're
yeah, Gemini decided Gemini, to piped in.
Yeah, Gemini must think we're a deli. Buttered roll.
Yeah, that's good. I think I'm gonna leave that in. Yeah, record it.
So I say that the truth is in the nouns. If you go deep enough, learn to go deep. Okay? Learn to ask what. Never ask why. Why is a challenge. If you need to know why, say, could you provide some context, please? I'm confused. Don't be afraid to be confused and to lack knowledge. You can use them as tools. Say, I'm sorry, I don't make jewelry. Please tell me about making jewelry. And I did write a system that made jewelry that recovered 8 pounds of gold. 8 pounds, a gallon of milk's worth of gold from dead inventory. Okay? Please tell me. I want to know what you touch. Don't ask people what they do. They can't tell you. They internalize it too much. I can't tell you how I write software. No. Ask people what they touch, what they handle, what passes over their desk, what their colleagues touch, how items and information moves.
So let me, I know one of your favorite questions that you would ask in software engineering interviews was the quadratic equation.
Oh, yeah.
Can you explain that? That's I always like that.
Ah, well, when I interview people, I like to know, to discover how they think, to actually take a journey with them through their thoughts. Okay. And I'm evaluating two things, what they can do and what they can learn. Okay. And I'd rather have somebody work with somebody who can do little and learn a lot than someone who can do a lot and learn a little. Okay, because the half-life of knowledge is very, very short.
Especially in this field.
Yeah. I mean, at one time, I could recite entire Prime manuals from memory. What good is that now? It's good material for storytelling, and it'll be clear to anyone who listens to this, I love telling stories. Okay? But as a practical matter, it's not worth much, but the ability to go into a system and learn about it and use it effectively, okay, to come up to the speed, to come up to that 80% level where you're able to function quickly by digging into the nouns, okay, which is how I do it, that'll sustain you for a lifetime.
So the question.
So the question is, you know, how do you think?
No. So the question that you ask.
The question that I ask is, it's very simple, okay? I like to ask this with people at the beginning of their careers. I say, you know, there's no requirement that you know the answer to this question, okay? Not knowing or not remembering is fine. But do you happen to remember the formula for solving a quadratic equation? No tricks, just what we all learned in high school, okay? I just want to make sure you know it by way of preparing for you to ask a question. And we make sure that, you know, they remember the formula properly. I said, okay, all I want you to do is to write a program to solve quadratic equations. You may be in C, solve it. Okay? Any way you want, any language you want, you can write it in, you know, just write the steps down if you want. You don't even have to write it in computer language. I just want to see how you go about doing it. Now, you might ask, but they know the answer, okay? Why do you ask them? Why do you give them the answer? Well, of course, I don't give them the answer. I give them the easy part, okay? The hard part, what are the inputs? What are the outputs? What are the outputs to add to that, okay? What are the preconditions, okay? Well, postconditions and invariants are not so relevant in this case, right. Okay? I've had people do the doggondest things. A, B, and C, int. Not checking if A is zero is not zero. Okay? A is non-zero. What do you do if it's zero? Okay? Well, what are your choices? Well, you can say naughty, naughty. Or you can say, okay, it's zero. I'll treat it as a linear equation. And there are arguments for either one. Okay? It's ambiguous. I want the candidate, the potential future colleague, to tell me, how do you, what's your opinion? Okay, these are matters of opinion and value and personal values and engineering methodology. Okay, what do you do if the discriminant is negative? Okay, what do you do? Well, some people would say to throw an you throw an exception because it's wrong, but is it wrong to ask how many roots an equation has when it has none? Is it wrong? What do you do in the degenerate case where there's only one root? Okay, the ideal candidate would treat A equals zero one way or the other. It doesn't matter. As I say, there's justification for both. Return zero roots if there are zero roots. Return one root if there's one root. Return two roots if there are two roots. So you return an array or a list, I don't care which. So, and I've had in interviews, you know, I was interviewing at some bank and they asked me these really easy questions. And I, you know, wanted to get a feel of them. So I told them, you know, if you're interested in what I would ask in circumstances like this. And I gave them this question. They look at me puzzled and I told them why. And they said, but that's unfair. I said, nobody's ever said that to me before. What's unfair about it? I said, well, the candidate doesn't know what you want. I said, but that's the way it is in this world.
Right.
It's ambiguous. It's imprecise. Right.
I mean, part of your job as a software engineer is to find out what the...
Yeah, to find out what the right thing is.
Okay. So just to wrap it up, so what do you do now that you've retired?
Well, I mentor a robotics team. And I'm looking for something interesting part-time to do, not necessarily, you know, lucrative immediately. I'm actually toying with the idea of learning COBOL because there's lots and lots and lots of part-time gigs using COBOL.
There's going to be lots of gigs to fix a Vibe code and application.
Yes, there is. That I think I could just walk in and do. Mm. Fixing applications, again, it would be very interesting because debugging, again, is largely a psychological game because you have to get in the head of the original author. How you get in ChatGPT's head, that would be an interesting question.
You don't want to go there. Okay. Well, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
That was a great conversation.
I enjoyed it, too. I hope our readers do as well.
Right.
Listeners. Sorry, not listeners. Readers. Right. I hope our listeners do as well.
Well, if you got to this point, thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.